Welcome to Slant Podcast. This is your host, Dana Tassouin-Burgess. This podcast is an ongoing conversation around the Asian American experience through the lens of artists and luminaries. Thank you for tuning in. Today's guest is acclaimed choreographer, Michael Mao, whose career spans over five decades. Michael shares stories about his early years training with dance pioneers Ted Shawn and Martha Graham to building his own acclaimed dance company, Michael Mao Dance, based in New York City. Michael has created over 60 dances. His work has been presented not only across the United States, but across the globe, from Europe to Australia and from Latin America to Asia. The U.S. Embassy in Beijing says Michael Mao reflects the diversity, the energy, and the talent of America. Welcome, Michael. Thank you for joining us today. I'd like to start at the beginning to understand what shapes an artist's lens. Michael, how and where did you grow up?
I was actually born in old China before the change in government in 1949, and then went through Southeast Asia and came to New York. I was five when we left China. It was quite a journey getting from Shanghai to New York. And so we settled in an immigrant community on Upper West Side, about 10, 15 blocks down from Columbia University. And it was full of immigrants from Hungary, from Germany, all over. And I went to school at Columbia Grammar School, which was very friendly. And a lot of the students had parents who had the same values as my parents, stress on education, hard work, and making contribution to society. I fitted in, and it was not a particularly athletic school, given the fact that it was in two or three townhouses. There was a gym, but it wasn't a jock school, so I did okay. I didn't feel left out or inadequate in any way, because I wasn't particularly great with sport or gym, for that matter.
Which is so amazing, because you became such a wonderful dancer. How did you come to dance?
Well, I think that looking back, when I was about seven, I was taken to a performance in Calcutta, India, by a group from China doing different dancers, folk dancers. And I remember very distinctly that the women were gliding on what seemed like lotus petals, water lilies. And I even remember at which moment I became curious, because when the dancer looked up on the diagonal, I turned my head, and I thought that was quite magical that he was able to redirect my attention. And I tried to teach dancers how to do that projection on stage. So these childhood influences can be enormous.
Absolutely. And those are such magical moments that you're describing as well.
Absolutely.
And you ended up then taking some dance classes, I assume, and then somehow in your history, you end up taking classes with Ted Shawn and Martha Graham as well. How did that all come about?
One summer in New York City, one of my sisters had a friend staying with us, and that friend was going to take the Martha Graham summer internship, because she wanted to teach that technique in the school that she taught. One morning, she said to me, "Well, Mike, put on your sweatpants. I'm going to take you to a dance class." I was a teenager, a skinny kid, and there I took my first Graham class. The only thing I remember was it was actually in the big studio downstairs in Graham's townhouse that Rothschild bought for her. And of course, the first thing across the floor was walking. Remember that I had seen ballet, and I walked the way that I had seen people walking on stage. a dancer called David Wood, one of Martha Graham's stars, clapped his hands, pointed at me and say, "You, skinny." And I went like, "Why is he picking on me?" And he mimicked me all the way across. And I thought I was just going to die.
Oh, no.
And then, of course, now looking back, it was ridiculous because he was a small man. I was a skinny kid, but taller than he was. But it was his presence, even in that studio, that was so enormous that I felt like a giant was picking on little David.
It's amazing how people can project a presence, isn't it? It's fascinating. And you also studied with dance pioneer Ted Shawn.
Yeah, I was at the Graham School for, I think, 3 or 4 years. But after that, somebody suggested to me to go to Jacob's Pillow. But I was very pleased that I indeed had gone, not only once, but twice. That was when Ted Shawn was alive and very much in charge and participating. He would teach class with Arthur Lulaw, one of his star dancers. And it was all of these forces pointed me in the direction of eventually joining a company. Even then, 50 years ago, I was surrounded in dance by multicultural, by diversity. In that case, I think that I was somewhat shielded from feeling left out or lonely, I mean, left out of the mainstream. I didn't feel that way because I was surrounded by all different people.
I can really see how that affects how you cast and how you have American dancers, you have international dancers, you do works which are abstract. Were presenters and audiences surprised by that internationalism, by that abstraction, and thinking like, oh, a choreographer of Asian descent, we're expecting something different?
Some do. And I'm lucky that some do, because then we get booked. But from the mid-80s through the mid-90s, the critics have already seen 3 different companies doing Chinese-themed work. And that is unfortunate because they already had an image in their minds that my work ought to look like that.
Like that, huh?
Something that had an Asiatic note to them. At that point, I think that there was only one fairly experienced choreographer in New York, that's Saigo Ichinoe. And Saigo actually also did abstract work. And then, of course, she probably also had to reckon with the way that the promoters and the critics were looking for Asians to do Asian work. So she eventually started choreographing like To the Tale of Genji and all of that. And my heart just went out to her because we should be able to do whatever we want. And I'm lucky that I was able to do a lot of it.
Your works so clearly reflect, again, that internationalism, that sense of movement from Shanghai to New York. Just to change the subject slightly, I just wanted to ask you another question. You know, I'm always struck by your generosity of spirit and positive attitude. Could you tell us about your work with teen immigrants, for which you recently received an award from the New York State Foreign Language Teachers Association?
Yes, I think that program started in the late 80s, early 90s. We had moved in with David Howard. We were on West 61st Street between 10th and 11th Avenue, and you have to walk by 3 or 4 blocks to go to a restaurant to get lunch. So a lot of people in the building would have lunch delivered. And these delivery boys would come in holding the bag with the ticket in front of them, who it was for. And the girl would just make a right turn, go down the hallway, turn left, and then turn right again. And then, of course, they come back again 3 minutes later. And then that finally realized, my God, they don't read, some of them. So then I would get up and I would tell them how to go, and I would use my body and I would use very simple words. And of course, they never come back. Now, the manager at that point was watching all of them day in, day out. And one day she said, why don't you put language and dance together? So it's really her idea. Well, I said, well, now that's a little bit different. That's not quite watering down the arts to kids, because I don't believe in that. I think kids should see any work just like adults.
They love a challenge. So,
that's right. And it's up to us not to be too obscure. And so we made this program. I had 13 dancers at that point. First, we would start with an introduction to the school, who we were. That's for school-wide, but the actual classes, ESL classes that we work intensively with, I would bring the whole company into any single class of 40 students. So the ratio of 13 to 40 is part of the ammunition.
That student-teacher ratio, it was a good one.
And the mandate is that stand on your head if you must. But you don't need to use language. And another thing that was difficult, using already choreographed movements. So artistically, we weren't watering anything down. We were actually teaching them our repertory from very elemental to more complex movement. So all of the action words we used were much simpler. A lot of them monosyllabic, easier to deal with. Punch, kick, turn. But I'll tell you one funny thing. Dancers who embraced the program, eventually not only could they speak better, they also dance more clearly. Movements are more brilliant because nothing is murky. They understand about articulation and coordination, because that's the same way with the muscle.
What's interesting how, as the word is defined, the body is defined, right? And
that's
vice
right.
versa.
That's
it's
right.
So interesting.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It also influenced my work, because for this program, we had to really use building block. A lot of my dancers that were successful from that period were indeed built like that. Because when I go into the studio and start making dances, that comes out very similar.
Like, it really affected you. Sure. Switching gears, I have two quick questions for you. While you were studying dance and performing, you also earned a BA in English from Princeton University and an MA from Harvard University. Can you tell us how you applied this knowledge to dance and how your education formed your view of the world?
The study of the literary genre, and specifically my discipline was literary analysis, made me understand how one can translate some of the same methods and devices to looking at the dance form. Or stage dancing, not participatory dancing, but in any situation that there's definitely an audience and the dancers and somebody or a team has put it together. And to that extent, I think that while there is a distinction of genre, meaning you don't compare apples and oranges in dance, it's all a mess. Different people using different criteria. People who are in the position A, to arbitrate, B, to decipher, and C, to review, and D, to confer awards or money. And in the end, they're talking around dance rather than what's germane to dance. So the good news is that there's a long ways to go in this art form of uncharted territory. But a lot of what I learned in literatures have allowed me to appreciate certain dance works more intensely and not to expect certain forms to do something that it's not meant to do.
Can I ask another question? How has the resurgence of anti-Asian violence affected you and your loved ones?
Well, it's curious because I've been domestic partner in New York City, and then the last 10 years married. And he was recruited by the State Department to be a regional medical director to take care of diplomats, psychiatric well-being. So when we're not in season, I follow him around covering these regions. And so in a funny way, half of the time I'm back in New York doing dance and half the time I'm out there. And also I go from where I live to 10 blocks away to City Center where we still have our quarters. And I don't go out at a certain point. You after work, you go home and you eat, and then you either do more of your work or you watch television. So it haven't happened to me. I feel very upset by it because I had thought that I wouldn't have to see this again. But I guess we've had some decades of relative peace. But it doesn't surprise me because when the economy is bad, ruthless leaders usually find a scapegoat. And in this instance, Chinese people. And of course, with racists, they don't care if somebody is Native American or Latina or certainly Japanese or Korean Americans. They just see a face and everybody is Chinese to them.
I was wondering, Michael, what's next for you? What should we be looking out for from you as an audience?
I'll tell you what we're doing. The mandate from my company, Michael Mao Dance, it's for me to make sure that all of the videotapes of works are being archived.
Oh, wonderful.
Or going to the New York Public Library, although it used to take them 10 years. Now it's even longer because there are many companies. And so they all want to be there. And some are just sending their stuff in. So there are delays. But we decided to convert it to the standard that they actually use, hoping that by the time they're ready to go, what I want to do is I want to put 15 to 30 second section that best gives an idea of what the work is, followed by a shorter version of the whole work, and then a longer version. In other words, just treat the attention span the way it is now for what it is that people can get a glimpse of it. And my board wants me desperately for me to write an account of the company.
Oh, that would be so inspiring.
And so I thought, well, the only people who might possibly would want to read it would be people who have spent time dancing with us. So I informally started asking some dancers I was in contact with about what question would they have for me if I die suddenly that they say, oh, I should have asked them, that would want to pick up the book and say maybe they can find out that answer. And of course, very humorous little exchanges. One dancer asked, her question was, after all these years of selecting dancers, what would I be looking for in a new dancer? And she was a beautiful dancer, full of character, very long on quality and all of those wonderful things that modern dance used to embody. And she was hoping I would say something along that line that she hadn't thought of. I wrote back and I said, loose hip joint. She wrote back with a face saying, that's it. And I did explain, I said, I've used all sorts of ways to make dancers who come to me maximize their innate talent. But one thing that I can change are their hip socket, that they are built really tight. Just so much I can do.
That's hilarious. Oh my God, I love that answer. Oh gosh.
Then the one that's in the last group of dancers who has interest in tradition and lineage and heritage and all of that, wrote back and said, what's your regret? Oh, I said, that would take a book for me to find out. Well, he said, I think that I have to address that issue. Despite all of this preservation effort, I have not lost interest in continuing to make dances and how the human body works the most efficiently. I've begun to ask very successfully to sit in on various countries, national ballet and modern dance classes to see how they work in class, regardless of the class they're given, and how they work in rehearsal, and hopefully also eventually how they work on stage. And so far, what's been very enlightening is that no matter what training they have come from, no matter what the class was, the ones who excel in rehearsal are the ones who in their bodies have a way of knowing how they should be working to deliver results immediately and further from what is generally taught in academy. And so that's a very rewarding thing to know that the teaching of dance still has to keep pace with the capable bodies. And that in itself has a great deal to learn.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you so much, Michael, because this has been just so great to hear your just wonderful, diverse history of how you came to dance and where the lens of your aesthetic comes from and all the different projects that you've undertaken in your career. And now hearing about the wonderful archiving that you're doing of the company is also very exciting. So we'll be looking for that as well.
Oh, thank you so much. And it's a delight always talking with you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for tuning in today. Please rate the podcast on your listening platform and tell your friends. Feel free to contact me at slantpodcast.com. It's always great to hear from you, our listeners. A special thanks to our sponsors, the Dana Tassuin Burgess Dance Company, the Cherry Blossom Giving Circle, and the Dedi Liam Gunawan Hickory Legacy Fund.